Greetings and welcome to another episode of Canadian History X. If you like, you can support the podcast for as little as $3 a month. Just go to patreon.com/CanadaEHX. You can also donate to the podcast by going to CanadaEHX.com and clicking donate. Don't forget, I have three other podcasts out there, From John to Justin, which releases every single Friday, Canada's Great War, which releases every single Sunday, and Coast to Coast, which releases every single Thursday. If you like, you can email me at craig@canadaehx.com. You can find me on Twitter. My handle is Craig Baird, CraigBaird, and I'm on Instagram at Bairdo37. Today I'm talking with Brian Kastner. He wrote the book Stampede, which is about the Klondike Gold Rush, and honestly, it's one of the best books I've read this year. I really enjoyed it because it takes you right down to the very people who made the Gold Rush. It's based in history, but the story and the interactions between the characters is fascinating. It was fantastic. I loved it. Let's get right to the interview.
What kind of got you interested in writing a book about the Klondike?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's not, I'm not a professional historian. I'm not an academic historian. And so it's not like this was my area of expertise or something. I have a military background. I have a journalist background, and I've done a lot of stories about wars and stuff, but I'm also, just like anybody, I'm interested in a variety of topics, and I feel really blessed and lucky that I've been able to write about a lot of different things. And I do like the outdoors, and I like travel. And the thing that appealed to me about, well, a couple of things appealed about the Klondike specifically. One is writing about the North, I find fascinating. I've written another book called Disappointment River, where I followed Alexander Mackenzie down the Mackenzie River to the Arctic Ocean. And that, in that particular case, I got to paddle the canoe and follow in his footsteps a little bit. Mm-hmm. So I like doing that kind of thing. But when I don't know, the Klondike for me, and maybe for you and for a lot of readers or other people, it's kind of this name, and it's a little bit of a brand, perhaps. I mean, it's literally an ice cream bar, right? So it's
true, yeah.
It's this thing you've heard of, but the details of the story I was unfamiliar with until I read Pierre Burton's, kind of infamous history of it in the 1950s. And as I read through it, I guess I saw an opportunity as a storyteller or as a person who focuses on narrative nonfiction and tries to focus on characters and plot and telling that kind of a TikTok story, so to speak. I said, there's a tremendous opportunity to kind of retell this story with modern eyes, with a lot of new research that's been done, not by me, but by, professional historians that have really done a lot of work in the 60 years since Burton wrote. And, I guess the thing that struck me was that the Klondike story is a disaster movie. It is shipwrecks and avalanches and murder and all of these things, scurvy and starvation and just the scale of it. That kind of extended human suffering, I guess, not to put too fine a point on it, is something I've really tried to explore in a lot of my other writing. And there's enough material in the Klondike that you could recreate people's experience of it.
Absolutely. And you did mention that you wrote another book about the Arctic with Disappointment River. Tell me about some of the other books that you wrote before you wrote Klondike or Stampede.
Yeah, my first book was called The Long Walk. And I was in the U.S. military. I was a bomb disposal technician. I was a bomb tech. We call it explosive ordnance disposal. And so I was taking part roadside bombs and the truck bombs and, doing that kind of work in Iraq. And I wrote, that was my first book, was kind of the story of doing that. But then also I had a lot of struggles coming home. And so it was a blended story of both fighting in Iraq and the trouble of reintegrating. I was not a professional writer before that. I kind of jumped in with both feet and into the cold part of the lake. And I feel fortunate that's how, once I started with that, I was able to keep writing about the military magazine stuff. I wrote another book called All the Ways We Kill and Die, which is about a good friend of mine who was killed in Afghanistan in 2012. And the investigation into the bomb maker that built the bomb that and designed the bomb that, you know, that hit his truck. But like I said, I'm interested in a variety of stuff. And I'm also a whitewater rafting guide. I'm a canoe guide. I spent a lot of time in the outdoors. And so I was hoping to write about more than just the war, right? And so it's, but kind of, I think I still bring that kind of maybe military veteran perspective to some of the writing. And it's not just, you know, the misery of some of these experiences, which you get a lot of in the military, but also, you know, the Klondike was, at least from an American perspective, there were a lot of former Civil War veterans, Civil War generals. You know, the story of the American Western frontier is really a post-Civil War story. And Americans viewed the Klondike as like the last frontier, even if Dawson City itself was inside Canadian borders. There's a whole Alaskan component to it, right? So I think, you know, looking at it through that lens, and you know, understanding that it was a lot of veterans, George Washington Carmack, who is one of the people competing for credit in the discovery of the Klondike, he was a former U.S. Marine, right? So having that perspective, I think, you know, does change how I write some of these stories.
Reading it, kind of, you dive right in with the story about Robert Henderson, who I feel like he's like the Pete Best of the Klondike. You know, he was there, and just before it kind of takes off, he loses everything. Like he doesn't get any gold. Like, I felt really bad for the guy. I actually thought he was a character that you kind of integrated into it, and then I felt really bad that he was an actual person that went through this. Were there any kind of favorite characters in this? Or when I say characters, I mean obviously historical figures that you really liked or liked writing about in your book?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's some people that I guess I had a natural affinity to. Tappan Adeney is an obvious one. He was the correspondent for Harper's, but he was also an avid outdoorsman and really learned that in New Brunswick. I mean, he was an American that spent a lot of time in New Brunswick and then eventually served in the Canadian military in World War I and retired in New Brunswick. And so, like, I think because he's a writer and a journalist, I'm attuned to him. But actually, the character I have the most sympathy for is Anne de Graaff, who was not looking for gold. She was looking for her son. And she was a widow and was sure her son, who had gone missing, would go on the gold rush. And so she goes herself. And, you know, everybody called her mother on the trail. She eventually, you know, becomes a bit of a mother figure for a lot of the women up in Dawson City who are working as dancers or, you know, as sex workers or in other ways. And so I think, you know, being a dad, I felt the parenthood connection to her. This idea that she would go on this incredible journey just to search for her son was, you know, I guess really compelling for me.
From a Canadian perspective, when we think of the Klondike, you know, we think of people like Sam Steele, who you do have in your book as well, or just, you know, Dawson City and, you know, how it was a rough and tumble place and all of that. But your story also kind of looks at the people who didn't have that success, like Robert Henderson, but especially Arthur Dietz and, you know, his journey over the glacier and just how unbelievably horrible that that was. Do you feel like this book can kind of show that, you know, the Klondike, yes, a lot of people did get rich, but for a lot of people, this was a very tough time in their lives. In fact, for some, probably the worst time in their life.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, there was an economic depression right before gold was discovered. And a lot of people were looking at, you know, they're making 10 cents an hour putting pickles in a jar or shoveling coal or something else. And the gap between rich and poor was enormous. And, you know, they were looking for a solution to their problem. And then the newspaper said, well, there's gold in the Klondike. And like, that would be the solution, right? But all of those inequities between rich and poor and the 99% who are poor and the 1% were rich just got recreated in the Klondike. And if you look at the numbers, something like 100,000 people probably went on the journey. And, you know, only about a third or 40% of them ever made it to Dawson City. So that 60 or 65%, which is 60 or 60,000 people, Yeah, a lot of them turned back, but a lot of them died. And we have no idea how many died. And there were so many shipwrecks on the West Coast of BC, but eventually they just stopped printing them as stories in the newspaper. And of course, you had a lot of people that left Edmonton and tried to go up the Front Range of the Rockies. And, you know, only a handful of those people ever actually made it to Dawson City. We don't really have a good sense of the loss of life. And then the people that got up there, you know, many of them just never even bothered trying to get a claim, because all the best ones were taken, obviously. Yeah. By the time they made the journey, people already up in the Yukon and Alaska had already made the best claims. And so there is a bit of a rise and fall of Rome tragedy to the story that, maybe it wasn't a conspiracy theory, but it was a bit of a Ponzi scheme. That the people who got in first made money and basically everybody else. Yeah, some people left with pride that they had taken such a journey and lived through it, but a lot of them left with nothing.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. There's lucky people like Jack London who can make a career afterwards based on their experience from the Klondike. But like you said, most came back with nothing, if that. In Canada, obviously, the Klondike is very famous. Where I'm from, I'm just outside of Edmonton. You know, we used to have Klondike days and we used to have the Klondike Kate competitions and all this. I guess the only other one I can think of is maybe the California Gold Rush. Why is the Klondike still so famous? Why is it something that people still recognize, over almost 125 years later?
Yeah, I think, it's the last and the greatest is the way it's often described. And it was really about the gold. I mean, in California, a lot of people were homesteading. They wanted to go to California anyway, and the mm-hmm. gold was a good excuse at the time, and the land had just been taken from Mexico, and there was this whole, settlement aspect to it. People were not trying to homestead in Dawson City. It was really focused on getting rich and getting rich quick. And when it comes to the number of people that moved in such a short period of time, it was extremely condensed. It was to these extremes of geography, to the extremes of weather, of course. It really combined a lot of these, just like the absolute limits. And the fact that people left into the teeth of winter, you have this iconic photography, of course, of people trying to go up the Chilkoot Pass and this kind of string of ants. I think all those things combined, the modern communications, the telegraph and newspaper stories about it, the photography that came out, and just it was a bit of an epic of its age. But it's also true, I think, that why did it become a legend? It was marketed as a legend almost immediately. I mean, gold was discovered in 1896. The stampede went from 1897 and 1898. And by 1899, there were already tourists. And they were already putting up hotels and gambling dens and all these shows and everything else, not marketing it to prospectors, but marketing it to tourists who are coming up to experience this, mm-hmm. right? And so it was almost a myth from the beginning. And at least on the American side, Teddy Roosevelt becomes president and, there's a new century and people are looking forward to the future. And it's like the Klondike Gold Rush was an old West myth from almost the moment it happened.
Mm, absolutely. Obviously, when you're writing the book, there's certain people that it's kind of easy to include, like Sam Steele or, Soapy Smith, like these very well-known, in some ways, extravagant characters. But how did you go about choosing who would be in this book? What people you would kind of open up their story?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, there's some figures that you almost like just have to include, like Soapy mm-hmm. Smith and Sam Steele. And the benefit of including them is, it's really what, trying to find those lesser known characters too. Like there's been a lot of scholarship done. Sam Steele is a well-known person. Dr. Rod McLeod at University of Alberta has just written an excellent biography of him. There's all of his papers there at the University of Alberta. There's just a lot of material, mm-hmm. but it turns out that there is, in the time since Pierre Burton wrote, there is a number of families have published the memoirs of their grandmother or great grandmother. You know, there's a lot of letters and papers that have come to light. And so for somebody like Anna DeGraff, who was probably unknown to Burton, you know, her memoir came out in, I guess, the 1980s or 1990s. You know, I'm looking for somebody that just has a lot of material to work with. There's other kind of iconic characters. Klondike Kate might be one, or Diamond Tooth Gertie, or some of these people. There's just not the depth of material where you can write, with a lot of confidence if you're going to keep it to nonfiction and if you're going to try to tell a narrative and not just say that these people existed, but try to describe what did they do from one day to the next? What did they do from 1 hour to the next on specific days? And so I was trying to find a mix of those famous and not so famous people where there was so much material that I could very confidently, you know, write up, you know, not just what they did, but like what it felt like to be there. Belinda Mulrooney is a good example. You know, she gave an oral history to a writer and then the book was never published, but there is at the Bancroft Library in California, just page after page after page of her words to her story. That means you can, you can really mine that for, you know, in some cases, what she was saying in the dialogue and really recreate it.
You mentioned like Klondike Kate, and then there's others that you kind of touch on very briefly in the book. Was there anybody that you wanted to maybe look at more, but like you said, the research or the information just wasn't there to make it feasible, but there was somebody like that you wanted to have in the book, but just couldn't?
Well, I think the biggest examples are Skookum Jim and Kate Carmack, his sister, and the other Indigenous voices in the book, where we have some. And there has been a lot of work, especially trying to get as much about Kate Carmack, in Tlingit, her name is Shaw Claw, but George Carmack couldn't pronounce her name. And so he renamed her Kate. You know, that is just indicative of kind of her whole life and experience. Yeah. We have stories about her, but we have almost nothing in her own voice. I found one letter at the University of Washington archive that I managed to include. But, you know, the Indigenous voices was really difficult. Now, there has been good work on oral histories, and Skookum Jim's role in the discovery of the gold has always been in the Tlingit oral histories. I wish there was more. I wish I could have fleshed that out further, but I got about as far as I could with the sources that I had.
In regards to research, what was that like? Like, was it a long process? Were some people, like you said, Sam Steele, easier than others? How did you go about doing the research for the book?
Well, the first step was to identify, 10 or 11 people that I thought would best tell the story. Nobody saw the whole thing. Like you said, Robert Henderson was involved in the beginning and missed out. And then Belinda Mulrooney sees a piece and Sam Steele sees a piece. There was no way to pick a single character to tell the whole story. So I knew I was going to have to find a few that would each get a piece of it. But then when I'm coming at this as a journalist and as a storyteller and somebody who's a narrative nonfiction writer, not as a historian. So my goal was never to discover some brand new thing that nobody had seen before or write it through an academic lens in like a new way. My goal was just to tell a great story. And so the research is, again, finding that material. But then, I know how to do interviews and I know how to recreate a scene out of those interviews. And I really looked on the oral histories or the memoirs as my interview notes. So instead of me having my own transcript from an interview, it's essentially like somebody else conducted it. And I would have asked maybe different things, but you have the material you have and you try to do the best you can with it. And I think for me, looking at their words as interview notes was a really important step because then it gave me a frame. Okay, this is what they say happened. What other secondary sources do I have to corroborate what happens? And then how do I put all these pieces together?
Then, so once you're done the research, you start writing the book. How did you go about writing it? How did you kind of look to fill in maybe some of the gaps, you know, especially during times where there might not have been a lot of information or maybe journal entries or things like that? How did you go kind of about filling in those little gaps and writing the book from start to finish?
Yeah, I went one character at a time and kind of not in order because I was so taken with Anna DeGraff's story. I actually wrote hers first. And then I think Tappan Adney's, and then I kind of started at the beginning again and started to work my way through. I mean, I just immerse myself in the material to the point where like I'm dreaming about it and thinking about it in the shower. And that's how I know when it's time to get the words out. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think it's when you have a gap, you have to decide if you're going to believe somebody else's version of the story or if you're going to, I don't know, sometimes skip that gap or you're going to try to fill it in with other, you know, with another treatment. I mean, some of the gaps, for example, Jack London, who did the Chilkoot Trail, mm-hmm. he wrote later in his life about running the whitewater, like the White Horse Rapids, for example, on the Yukon. But he didn't write about every step of the journey. And his, he had a companion who was with him who did keep a journal. And so we know where he was every day, but not necessarily what he saw every day. Mm-hmm. Well, I hiked the Chilkoot myself to get, you know, to get my own impressions. And so, you know, what was the view like from this place? Could you see the glacier or not? What was it like to go down this trail? What does this canyon look like? I mean, some of that I could give him from my own observations because mm-hmm. I stood in the place and was able to see it and the land hasn't changed. I mean, the trees have grown back, but the land hasn't changed that much.
Mm-hmm. And so now, like I said, it's a really great book. I've been really enjoying it. I'm like I said, I'm just at, I've kind of got to the John Healy's part and then I see that Soapy Smith is coming up next. But it's been very interesting to read right from, you know, the start where Robert Henderson impales his leg right up to this point. What's next? What are you thinking of writing about next?
Oh, that's, well, that can sometimes be a harder question than you think. Have I gotten it past my agent and my publisher? I don't know. I continue to write the thing that continues to draw me to nonfiction is kind of two things. One is, the sense when I stumble upon a story that I can't believe is both true and I've never heard of and just has these extremes like the Klondike story does. And then the other one is, I guess what I tell myself is, you know, what can I, you know, what can I investigate and bring back and demythologize? What can I, what's out there that's like not Googleable, but, you know, would really have an ad. And what I mean by that is, you know, I also, a lot of my journalism say is in Africa or the Middle East, and you're going to places where you really have to go and interview people and find out things that's like kind of not on the internet otherwise. And I don't know, this may be a funny way to think about it, but in 2021, where so much information is immediately available, you know, going to a place and finding out things that aren't knowable otherwise, and then trying to tell that story in the best way possible. That's what continues to fascinate me about nonfiction. And that's, I mean, that's even what drew me to the Klondike, is knowing that these stories were in archives, that all this new work had been done, but there was a way to tell the story in a new way. And it wasn't just dancing girls and happy prospectors and smiling Mounties, that it was also this like really truly miserable experience, not just on the travel, but also, you know, the violence against the women up in Dawson City, the violence against Indigenous people, trying to, like I said, demythologize and tell a fuller story. That's what continues to motivate me in my writing. And so the trick is going to be to find out whatever the next version of that is.
Absolutely. And, you know, the horrible things like you write about, like the Dead Horse Trail, or, you know, the number of people who had to eat their dogs. I have a dog, so, you know, I never like reading about that stuff, but it is absolutely something that happened. I just try to remember that was a long time ago.
I mean, all of these things really did happen. And I just, I guess the thing that, again, continues to just, you know, light the fire for me is to know that a story has been sugarcoated. Mm-hmm. And the details of it may be forgotten and sometimes purposely, you know, mythologized, and to strip that away and say, no, here's the reality of what happened. And let's face that. And this is how Indigenous people were lynched. And this is how women were abused. And this is how people were murdered and froze to death. And I think that's where hopefully I add value, is trying to tell a fuller picture of what really happened.
Absolutely. Like I said, with Edmonton, when we used to have Klondike Days, we used to celebrate Edmonton obviously being part of the trail, but ignoring the fact that the vast majority of the people who took the Edmonton way never even made it to the Klondike. It was, like you said, it was an extra like 1,000 kilometers to go. It was a horrible way to go, even though it was overland.
Right. Right. And I mean, people were reduced to trying to cook their shoes. And most of those, you know, I mean, most people on the Edmonton Trail died of scurvy. Right. Mm-hmm. So it was, and again, they died anonymously. I would read, I mean, I spent a lot of time reading hometown newspapers in this time. And first they would obviously report that gold was discovered. But then as the months went by, there would be little snippets like 6 people from this town in Ohio, you know, drowned in a river. And here were their names. And then that's it, you know, and they would report it a little bit, but nobody, including me, has really tried to go through all of those newspapers and all of those hometowns and write down everyone's name who drowned essentially anonymously in the river. I mean, but there was, but the people on the trail would tell a story that they would just see people face down or see people lying on the side of the trail frozen to death. And then they just kept going.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Like I say, it's a fascinating story. I've always been interested in the Klondike, and I did an episode on it on my podcast back in January, because it is something that a lot of people are interested in. And the book was fantastic for really diving deep into the lives of these people, both, you know, the ones who got rich and the ones who had a horrible experience like Dietz. I guess the last question is, where can people find the book? Where can they find you? If you have a website, any social media, anything like that?
Yes, thanks. So you should be able to buy the book at bookstores across Canada, and you can buy it online. You can find me at briankastner.com. Kastner is C-A-S-T-N-E-R. There's links to other books and ways to buy it there. And I spend, as a journalist, I spend way too much time on Twitter. So I'm at Brian_Kastner. That's where all the, you know, the latest and best stuff is.
I hope you enjoyed that interview. And if you did, please leave a rating and review. If you like, you can reach me through email at craig@canadaehx.com. You can also visit my website. You will find hundreds of articles on Canada's history, as well as all my podcast episodes. Just go to canadaehx.com. And don't forget, you can support the podcast through Patreon. There are multiple tiers to choose from, all with great benefits. You can support the podcast for as little as $3 a month, just like all of these wonderful patrons have. And I apologize if I mispronounce any names. Randy Hayden, Doug Campbell, Reg W, Deborah Carlson, Francis Helbling, Randall McCallum, Diane Wade, Lorianne Kirby, Gary Dolovich, Nick Zinri, Shannon Marshall, Clinton Martinez, Dimitri Chauve, Aaron O'Hara Myers, Robert Dunseith, Todd Casey, Catherine Rawa, Luke S., J.P. Bear, Jason Hall, Phil Maynard, and Iris Gray. If you want, you can find me on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/CanadianHistoryX. You can find me on Twitter. My handle is Craig Baird, CraigBaird. And you can find me on Instagram. Just go to Bairdo37. Thanks. We'll see you again next time.